Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and later this year, the Supreme Court will decide whether a bakery in Colorado was justified in refusing to sell a wedding cake to a same-sex couple on religious grounds. You know that case. The decision centers on the First Amendment and whether compelling a person to provide a service that goes against their religious beliefs violates their right to free speech. But the person in this case, as it has been presented to the court, is not actually a person. The rights being argued for are those of Masterpiece Cake Shop, the business that refused to sell to the couple. At stake is the future of corporate rights. Many see Citizens United as providing the groundwork for corporate rights, that campaign finance decision. But my guest today explains that extending fundamental rights to businesses is older than even the United States, and that corporate personhood, at least as it's normally understood, is not really the issue. Adam Winkler is a professor of constitutional law at UCLA and the author of We the Corporations, How American Businesses Won Their Civil Rights. In this new book, Winkler examines the 200-year history of American constitutional law over which the corporate rights movement, as he calls it, has taken place. Professor Winkler, welcome back to WNYC. Hi.
Thanks so much for having me.
In the context of corporate history, how significant is the Masterpiece Cake Shop case?
Well, I think the Masterpiece Cake Shop is a very important case. It's a case that really presents the question about whether a corporation has a constitutional right to refuse to do service with certain customers. And we've been here before. I found in my research for We the Corporations, in 1907, the Supreme Court first confronted the question of a corporation that wanted a constitutional right not to do business with certain unwanted customers. And the Supreme Court rejected that claim 100 years ago. I'm not sure that the Supreme Court today will follow that lesson.
When most people think of corporate rights, the phrase corporations are people is likely to be one of the first things that comes to mind, either earnestly or sarcastically. We remember Mitt Romney in 2011 when he was running for president arguing in this clip that they are.
Corporations are people, my friend. We can raise taxes on, of course they are. Everything corporations earn ultimately goes to people.
To which President Obama, during that election cycle, replied,
I don't care how many ways you try to explain it. Corporations aren't people. People are people.
Is that the right frame of the debate from either side?
Really not. If we look back, I look back in my book at this long history of corporations claiming fundamental constitutional protections. And the first Supreme Court case on the rights of African Americans, for instance, was not decided until 1857. But the first Supreme Court case on the rights of corporations was decided in 1809. And indeed, if you look back at the history, you find that rarely does the Supreme Court say that corporations are people. Occasionally it does. But most of the time, the court says that corporations have rights because the people inside them have rights, and the corporation's entitled to protect those rights for them.
And I think that is really what Mitt Romney was trying to say, if not very artfully, that a corporation is the people who own the companies, whether those are shareholders in a public company or the individuals in a private company. And so he was putting it in terms of taxes, if you raise taxes on corporations, then you're really raising taxes on individuals, and those are going to be passed along. And so I guess to extend it to Masterpiece Cake Shop, if you limit the religious liberties of corporations, you're really limiting the religious liberties of individuals who own that corporation. How do you see that?
Well, I think that can make sense in some cases. The problem is that view of the corporation might have made sense 200 years ago when corporations were all very small. But especially today when many of the corporations, and especially the ones we're most concerned about in public policy, are big publicly held corporations where many of the people invest through pension funds and mutual funds and don't even really know exactly which stock they hold, it doesn't really quite make sense to think of corporations as associations of citizens the way the Supreme Court often does.
Was the Citizens United campaign finance case a turning point in corporate personhood, or I should say corporate constitutional rights?
I think of it more as a continuation of a longer trend. What we saw is, for most of constitutional history, the Supreme Court said corporations have property rights, but not liberty rights. They had the right to protect their assets, so the government couldn't take their property to build a highway, for instance, without paying just compensation. But at the same time, the court said corporations do not have the right of free speech, of personal conscience. What's become controversial in recent years is that the Supreme Court has extended more and more liberty rights to corporations.
And one of the central themes of your book, I think, is that corporations have not actually gained most of their rights by establishing their personhood. So expand on that a little bit more. What has been the main arc of corporate constitutional rights?
Well, we see that that corporations, like women and minorities, have really fought to gain equal rights. They weren't mentioned by the framers, and the men who wrote the Constitution and the people who ratified it weren't thinking about protecting corporations at the time. And while corporations, unlike women and minorities, don't march in the streets carrying signs demanding equal rights, they have fought for 200 years for Supreme Court cases extending those rights to them. And really, the key to their success has not been any grand theory of the corporation or way of thinking about the corporation, as much as the fact that they've had access to the best lawyers money can buy, the lawyers to make the most creative arguments, and the resources that corporations have to finance cutting-edge, high-risk litigation campaigns, something that civil rights movements generally haven't had the resources to afford.
So what's the risk? Why should people care a lot about whether corporations have constitutional rights?
Corporations use those rights to strike down laws that are adopted to protect investors, consumers, or the public at large. So, for instance, we've seen in recent years corporations use the First Amendment to strike down graphic cigarette warning labels, even though we know that those are very effective at discouraging smoking. We've seen companies like Hobby Lobby claim an exemption from a requirement that they provide birth control for their employees in employee health plans. So when corporations have these rights, they use them like, a Jedi lightsaber, that they can strike down laws regulating business. And I think that hurts the rest of us.
Listeners, do you have any questions for law professor Adam Winkler from UCLA? His new book is We the Corporations, How American Businesses Won Their Civil Rights. We can talk more about the history in his book or the current state of corporate rights and the risks and benefits of that. We'll also ask Adam after a break how this relates to his previous book that you may know him from, called Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. He's definitely a Second Amendment expert as well as a First Amendment expert. Both of those so much in play right now in the national conversation, and we'll ask him where they connect. And we invite your phone calls, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Stay with us.
Next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour, staff writer Jane Mayer on the elusive Christopher Steele, the former British spy behind the Russian dossier.
He made a kind of a very strong impression on me because he was trying very hard to get across something that you could see he actually really believed strongly in, which was that the U.S. was in danger.
That's next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour. Saturday mornings at 10 on 93.9 FM, WNYC.
Support for WNYC comes from New Jersey Performing Arts Center, presenting Johnny Mathis April 13th. Johnny Mathis will perform Chances Are, It's Not For Me to Say, and more. Tickets available at njpac.org. NewJerseyNext.com, an arts, lifestyle, and events website connecting and celebrating the people and happenings of New Jersey. Learn more at njnext.com. The Band's Visit, a new Broadway musical. A mix-up sends a group of Egyptian musicians to a remote Israeli town. When the locals take them in for the night, their lives intertwine. Ticket information at thebandsvisitmusical.com.
And tomorrow on The Brian Lehrer Show, it'll be Friday, so Mayor de Blasio will join us for your weekly chance to ask the mayor. Plus Congressman Adriano Espaillat on national politics and his Upper Manhattan district. And we'll hear from one of the Democrats now in a runoff election for Congress for a chance to unseat an incumbent Republican in Texas. So one of the survivors from that combative Texas primary day on Tuesday, military veteran Mary Jennings Hager will join us on tomorrow's Brian Lehrer Show. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with UCLA law professor Adam Winkler, author now of We the Corporations, How American Businesses Won Their Civil Rights. And I mentioned before the break that Adam also wrote Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. And is there a connection between your two books, those two books in particular, or did you just happen to look at those two different topics at two different times?
Well, they are two different topics at two different times, sort of united by, I think, in both books, really looking deep into a hidden or secret history about something that we often take for granted. In the gun case, it was our Second Amendment and how we think about and balance gun rights with gun control. And this one's more about corporate power. And they are coming together, these two ideas. We're seeing corporations almost lead the charge right now against the NRA, with companies like Delta and others pulling back discount plans. We're seeing corporations exert their political muscle, if you will, now in the gun debate, too.
On the other side of that, though, sometimes I think there's a misnomer about who the NRA represents, and I'm curious to get your take on this, that it's not just simply that they represent the large number of gun owners in the United States. It's that most of those gun owners don't support the more radical positions of the NRA, do support things like assault weapons bans, but the NRA, and people don't realize this so much, really represents the gun manufacturers. So it's if you're talking about Dick's Sporting Goods and other places where corporate America is pushing back against the NRA, it's corporation against corporation. How much do you see it that way?
Well, I do think obviously there's a symbiotic relationship between the NRA and the gun makers, and the gun makers rely on the NRA to support its products, and the gun makers support the NRA by financing ads in the American Rifleman and in other magazines. I do think that the NRA's real strength on election day does come from the ability to sway voters who really are – there are a number of single-issue pro-gun voters. I think what we're seeing in the mobilization past in the wake of Parkland is that we're maybe seeing the rise of more single-issue pro-gun control voters. And if that's the case, that could have a big impact on the gun debate.
Faraz in Queens, you're on WNYC with Adam Winkler. Hello, Faraz.
Hello there. So the question I had for the professor is, under the auspices of President Trump, do we foresee corporations being treated much differently than they have been in the past?
Well, that's a great question, and I think we've already seen a tax bill adopted that seems to favor big corporations and big business much more than the average person or average consumer. So indeed, we are seeing corporations gain considerable strength. One of the things that I show in my book, though, is that corporations have always been politically powerful, and even in places where we don't always suspect it. You know, Citizens United and whatnot make us think about corporations and their influence on elected officials and on legislation. But there's also been a story about how the courts have become a haven for big corporations, too, and that corporations have used and exerted their power in the judiciary, too, to gain really our most fundamental rights.
Moshe in Flushing, you're on WNYC. Hi, Moshe.
Oh, hi, Brian. Thank you very much.
Sure.
I'd like to make two related points about the liability of corporations for what they do. The first is that it's bugged me forever that the Republicans keep saying corporations are people, but oddly enough, people can go to jail and corporations can't. And I'd like to ask the professor if there's ever been an equivalent of putting a corporation in jail. I mean, we bake them up with antitrust law, but I can't think of a real jail analogy, and maybe he can suggest one. Secondly, I'd like to offer the idea that the Supreme Court's analysis in the Hobby Lobby case fell short. The proper response to them should have been, hey, it's a limited liability corporation. You guys aren't liable for the sins of a corporation. If the corporation is a person, it's the corporation committing the sin of, you know, supposed sin of supporting birth control. And you don't have anything to worry about. It'll be the corporation that goes to hell.
Adam?
Well, those are two very different and important questions. The first on the question of corporations and their liability for criminal offenses. Indeed, for most of human history, we've had corporations since the about 300 years before Christ. And for most of that time, they were not ever held liable for crimes because it was thought that they couldn't, as artificial persons, couldn't create the nefarious intent that was necessary to engage in a criminal activity. But that changed about 120 years ago or so, and we have held corporations criminally liable, although they don't obviously go to prisons, they don't have bodies. And one of the interesting things I found is that was back in the early 1900s when corporations first claimed the Constitution's rights for criminal defendants, such as a right against unreasonable searches and seizures and a right against self-incrimination. Many of our constitutional rights are about criminal defendants, and as corporations became held liable for crimes, they asserted those same constitutional rights. And on to the Hobby Lobby case, I think the caller is exactly right. I think that the idea of corporate personhood means that a corporation is its own independent entity with its own legal rights and its own legal duties, wholly separate from the rights and duties of the members. And just as Hobby Lobby would claim the protection of limited liability if there was someone who would slip and fall in a Hobby Lobby store, they shouldn't be able to assert their own religious liberty and impose that on the business corporation.
On corporations being held accountable under the law, like you say, you can't put a corporation in jail. But I once heard of a protest sign at a protest rally that said, "I'll know corporations are people when Texas executes one." And it's funny, but on the other hand, you can't jail a corporation, but in theory, the government could rule that there's such a thing as a corporate death penalty and some corporate crime was so egregious that they get put out of business. Is there any such thing in real life?
There is such a thing. The law has long had legal rules that would allow a state that allows a corporation to incorporate there, that state could take that charter away and put the corporation out of business entirely. So we do have a corporate death penalty, but it's almost never used, and especially with the ease by which businesses can relocate, can reorganize, can change their names, can shift their assets around, even a corporate death penalty probably wouldn't be long-lasting because unlike a real person, a corporation can magically reform and reappear somewhere else.
In one case you cite in your book, Marsh versus Alabama, the ruling was that corporations should be treated like governments. Can you explain that one?
Well, that's right. Ever since that first case back in 1809 that I mentioned earlier, the first Supreme Court case on the rights of corporations, corporations have kind of been on the individual side of the government versus individual debate. And they've been rights holders, just like you and me, Brian. But there was a case in the 1950s dealing with a company town, and the Supreme Court said that in the context of a company town that really controlled everything in the city and everything in the little area, that was more like a government, and that private company had to respect individual rights rather than to be able to claim individual rights like an individual citizen. But that was really a one-off case. The Supreme Court never went back there again, and it sort of maybe points to a lost possibility in constitutional law where we might think of our big, powerful corporations in some ways like governments and recognize that we need them to respect our rights too.
Rob in Bridgeport, you're on WNYC. Hi, Rob.
Hi, how you doing, Brian?
Okay.
I really listen to your show all the time. I think it's great. And the question I have is related to corporations having a vote at the same time that the individuals within that corporation that run that corporation also have votes. Isn't that effectively giving the individuals that run that corporation two votes?
Votes on what?
Whatever that might be, vote, because a corporation has the right to act as an individual.
Right. I said, we once actually, Adam did, and Rob, we once actually did an April Fool's segment on this show that said the premise was the Supreme Court has granted corporations the right to vote. As an extension of Citizens United, the premise was now the court has ruled, well, if corporations are people, people have right to vote in this country. And so then we went into the one corporation, one vote premise, things like that. But it was an April Fool's joke. Rob's asking seriously if corporations in some way have a right to vote. Do they?
Well, Citizens United didn't give them a right to vote, but maybe gave them something even more important and powerful, which is the right to spend unlimited amounts of money to influence the vote, to take out ads to influence voters. And given the amassed resources of corporations, that really is a lot of sway. And indeed, you might think it might be better for America if corporations had the right to vote, but not the right to spend unlimited amounts of money. They'd only have one vote. Meanwhile, they have billions of dollars that they can spend on ads. But the point that political activity by corporations also enhances the power of the individual executives, kind of giving them two votes, if you will, is an idea that is longstanding and all the way back 100 years ago when we first limited corporate influence in the electoral process after a big scandal involving Teddy Roosevelt. Part of the idea was that the executives of companies use politics to enhance their own personal political power, not really represent the shareholders.
We have 20 seconds left. How far do you see this corporate constitutional rights movement going? What comes next if they win Masterpiece Cake Shop?
I think we'll see more and more corporations claim exemptions from generally applicable laws, especially in the context of LGBT rights.
Adam Winkler, professor of constitutional law at UCLA, the author now of We the Corporations, How American Businesses Won Their Civil Rights. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening today. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Stay tuned for Midday.